a roommate's academic performance, or that a roommate wasn't involved in more extracurricular activities. If a roommate had been white and gotten a scholarship, Scotty Nell probably would have assumed her roommate somehow deserved the scholarship. Why did she not assume that? Because her roommate was black. But perhaps most significantly, it seems never to have dawned on Scotty Nell that she, along with all whites in the United States, might be the one who unfairly benefited from racial discrimination. Founded in 1927, the University of Tennessee admitted white students only for the first 34 years of its existence. Those students didn't get in because they were better than black students, but because they got a leg up from an exclusionary racist system in which they didn't have to fairly compete. Exclusion of black students from university admittance compounded the historic economic oppression of black families, further preventing black kids from getting higher quality jobs and thus continuing to leave generation after generation with little wealth. The result was that by the time Scotty Nell and her roommate were attending college, the national net worth of white households was on average $100,700 higher than the net worth of black households. It seems not to have occurred to Scotty Nell that the great economic injustice that has been inflicted on black families and continues to this day demanded some sort of solution, and that perhaps giving one black student a scholarship to attend one historically white university was a good start. When I brought up the historic injustices that faced her black roommate and her roommate's ancestors, Scotty Nell replied, "Why is that my fault? Why should she be given an advantage over me?" Now in California, in the thick of our dinner discussion about bias, she returns to the story with the same plea. Scotty Nell doesn't think it's her responsibility to right those past wrongs. Many Americans feel the same, because in the story they tell themselves about society and everyone's place within it, it just doesn't seem fair. But perhaps that story itself is what's wrong. In 2016, sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild published Strangers in Their Own Land, a book based on her time immersed with Tea Party members and Trump supporters in rural Louisiana, folks just like Scotty Nell. In it, Hochschild details what she calls the deep story that these folks believe. Not necessarily a true or factual story, but a feels-as-if emotional story. That is the subjective prism through which they see life and the other side of the political spectrum. Here is an excerpt of how Hochschild sums up that deep story. "You are patiently standing in a long line leading up a hill, as in a pilgrimage. You are situated in the middle of this line, along with others who are also white, older, Christian, and predominantly male, some with college degrees, some not. Just over the brow of the hill is the American dream, the goal of everyone waiting in line. Many in the back of the line are people of color, poor, young and old, mainly without college degrees. It's scary to look back there. There are so many behind you, and in principle you wish them well. Still, you've waited a long time, worked hard, and the line is barely moving. Look, you see people cutting in line ahead of you. You're following the rules, they aren't. As they cut in, it feels like you're being moved back. How can they just do that? Who are they? Some are black. Through affirmative action plans pushed by the federal government, they are being given preference for places in colleges and universities, apprenticeships, jobs, welfare payments, and free lunches. Women, immigrants, refugees, public sector workers, where will it end?" Hochschild shared a longer version of this deep story narrative with her many Tea Party interviewees, and they said it summed up their perspectives. And I heard Hochschild's deep story in my conversations with Scotty Nell, in her belief that her college roommate was cutting in line with her scholarship while Scotty Nell was being punished simply for being white. How Scotty Nell got to the middle of the line to begin with is largely invisible. She doesn't think about how her ancestors not only cut in line, but may have literally beat, enslaved, and killed the people at the back of the line in order to do so. Even if her ancestors didn't hurt anyone, the history and meaning of her whiteness put her in line ahead of others to begin with, just like men were systematically put ahead of her. Still, even if Scotty does think about any of that, she doesn't think it should matter now. The way Scotty Nell tells the story about her college roommate, it's like a fresh wound, like some moment in the past that is even more painful and pertinent today. The line is the way it is, and maybe having to suffer centuries of slavery wasn't fair then, but cutting the line isn't fair now. It was the Italian political theorist Antonio Gramsci who pioneered the concept of cultural hegemony, whereby the worldview of the elite becomes the accepted social norm. The historically dominant view in the United States that white people should rightfully have more privilege and power is a form of cultural hegemony. And groups who benefit from hegemony don't see their own bias. They just think that's the way things should be. As the saying goes, when you're accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression. But to Scotty Nell and so many others, concepts like privilege and implicit bias are really just politically correct code words for telling people like her to go to the back of the line and not feel angry about it, but guilty. In Scotty Nell's telling, racism isn't what elected Donald Trump. And she's not entirely wrong. Explicit racism played a role, the KKK voters and the alt-right and such, but thankfully it isn't embraced by a majority of Trump voters. And yet support for him was run through with white racial resentment and implicit bias. Donald Trump, as writer Ta-Nehisi Coates observes, is a white man who would not be president were it not for this fact. The white presidents before him made their way to high office through the passive power of whiteness, Coates writes. That bloody heirloom which cannot ensure mastery of all events, but can conjure a tailwind for most of them. Coates continues, land theft and human plunder cleared the grounds for Trump's forefathers and barred others from it. Once upon the field, these men became soldiers, statesmen, and scholars, held court in Paris, presided at Princeton, and advanced into the wilderness and then into the White House. Their individual triumphs made this exclusive party seem above America's founding sins. And it was forgotten that the former was in fact bound to the latter, that all their victories had transpired on cleared grounds. There is an ugly reality to the myth of these individual triumphs, and within that lies an alternative deep story, one that is arguably far closer to the truth. In the deep story of many people of color and progressive whites, the American dream is more like a dog pile than an orderly line. And certain groups of people clambered to the top by stepping on others throughout history and still today. White families don't have twice as much wealth on average today as black families because white people are smarter or harder working, but because of slavery and segregation and discrimination through which generations of white people exploited black people for their sole gain. And yeah, their great-great-grandkids don't own slaves or believe in separate water fountains, but they're still born at the top of the pile because of their race. It's not necessarily that their parents or grandparents handed them places on top because of their disproportionate wealth or education or good jobs, though certainly that happens for some, but the shape of the hill and who is generally on top versus on the bottom has been contoured by that bias, which in turn actively shapes our lives today. The people who aren't at the bottom of the dog pile think they got where they are, not because of history or luck, but because they deserve to be there. And the irony is that these are the people who believe the other deep story myth, the one about the orderly line. The people in the middle and top of the dog pile often believe life is an orderly line, when in fact, that's all the people at the bottom are asking for. The people at the bottom are desperate for the world to work the way that the people at the top insist it already does, for opportunity to be truly equal, and for achievement to be merit-based. It seems we can all agree on that ideal. What we disagree on is whether we've already achieved it or not. That doesn't mean there aren't white people who struggle, and even people of color who make it to the top. Of course, it's not that simple. See, for example, Barack Obama and Oprah Winfrey. But still, women and people of color and immigrants and poor people and queer folks and people with disabilities see that the deck is stacked against them more than it is for others, because objective evidence shows it is. And that's what's not fair. Whereas taking away from others the unfair advantage that they've wrongly enjoyed throughout history is, in the grand scheme of things, fair, even if it doesn't always feel that way. So while I agree with Scotty Nell that it's not her fault, or my fault, that our ancestors probably would have supported and certainly benefited from white supremacy, I think it is our duty to do something about it going forward. Sure, it's kind of like having to clean up a mess someone else made. Spend as much time as you want resenting that. But the fact is that, a lot like air pollution, that mess is making us all sick. The American dream has been broken for a long time. Lots of people are seeing their jobs disappear, their wages stagnate, their housing values implode, and their children's prospects dim. In the conservative deep story, we're all viciously competing with one another. In the progressive deep story, we all rise together or fall. What if your roommate had been white and she'd gotten a scholarship and you hadn't? I ask Scotty Nell as we continue our dinner. Wouldn't you then just chalk it up to her somehow deserving it more or being lucky? Probably, she replies. One thing I appreciate about Scotty Nell is her honesty. That's basically like admitting she thinks other white people deserve to be next to her in line, or even ahead of her, but that black people must be cutting. And that right there is implicit bias. During another one of our conversations, Scotty Nell goes off on Chicago's black community for tolerating poverty and drug use and violence. What makes you think they tolerate any of that? I ask. Because they haven't solved it, she retorts. Her implication is that the black community caused the problem, and it's their problem to solve, too. I ask Scotty Nell if she thinks that joblessness and drug abuse in the rural white Rust Belt is white people's fault. She gets defensive and insists, that's different. Is it? Ta-Nehisi Coates nails this central hypocrisy in how biased whites misperceive reality. Black workers suffer because it was and is our lot, but when white workers suffer, something in nature has gone awry. That's the ultimate attribution error, playing on our deep implicit biases. And again, lest you think I'm judging Scotty Nell alone, let's be clear. We all do this. Recently, there was a conference I wanted to speak at and I wasn't invited, but four white guys and one black woman were. I caught myself thinking that the black woman was only invited because she's black. But mind you, it never dawned on me that the four white guys were only invited because they're men. Automatically, I assumed the white guys are as equally qualified as I am, but the black woman wasn't quite. That she got the slot not also because she was equally as qualified as me, but because of her race. That's exactly the same thing Scotty Nell was doing with her roommate, baked in biases playing out as subtle or not so subtle resentment. Similarly, I've had plenty of well-intentioned white friends bemoan not getting into graduate school or not getting hired for some job because they probably picked a person of color instead. But of course, they're good liberals who support affirmative action, so they quickly add something like, but that's a good thing, after their resentful complaint. I'm sure I've done that too. Again, there were probably dozens or even hundreds of other white people who were picked instead of them. But the unexamined assumption is that numerically many more white folks were actually qualified, whereas a single person of color would only or primarily be chosen because of their race. I don't think we're free in America, says criminal justice reform advocate Brian Stevenson. I think we are burdened by our history of racial inequality. We have a history of horrific mistreatment of people based on color, and I think that narrative of racial difference that was cultivated to justify that mistreatment has created a kind of smog, and we have all been breathing it in. Of course, unconsciously perceiving black people to be, say, more dangerous is different than explicitly wanting to subjugate all black people because you believe they are fundamentally and collectively inferior. People can have implicit racial bias and not have explicit bias, John Powell tells me. And yet, he continues, the conscious and unconscious is not disconnected. People who demonstrate explicit bias are also likely to show high levels of implicit bias, Powell explains. The biases in society that we absorb into our unconscious are vestiges of the legacy of explicit bias and hate in which our history is steeped. Pretending otherwise is either self-protective white fragility or denial. Psychologist Mazarin Banaji, co-developer of the IAT, who runs Project Implicit at Harvard, suggests a helpful way of thinking about the relationship between unconscious bias, explicit hate, and society in general. It would be disingenuous, if not in flagrant opposition to the evidence, to hold that if prejudice is not explicitly spoken, it cannot reflect a prejudice, Banaji writes, with IAT research colleagues Anthony Greenwald and Brian Nosek. Instead, Banaji proposes that we think about the thumbprint of the culture. Perhaps we behave in ways that are not known to our own conscious awareness, that we are being driven to act in certain ways not because we are explicitly prejudiced, but because we may carry in our heads the thumbprint of the culture, Banaji tells NPR's Shankar Vedantam. And the research on discrimination clearly shows that thumbprint leaves a very tangible mark. In civil rights and non-discrimination law, intentional discrimination is known as disparate treatment, which is basically when an employer or business or government agency explicitly, knowingly treats an individual or group differently because of their gender, race, religion, etc. But in 1971, the Supreme Court ruled in Griggs versus Duke Power Company that the 1964 Civil Rights Act prescribes not only overt discrimination, but also practices that are fair in form, but discriminatory in operation. In other words, discrimination doesn't have to be intentional to be illegal. Again, perhaps we can argue that explicit discrimination is on some moral or philosophical level worse, but in Griggs, civil rights advocates successfully argued that discriminatory impact matters as much or more than discriminatory intent. We might make the same argument with respect to bias. Sure, explicit bias is overt, but what matters most is impact, which can be just as pernicious whether rooted in implicit bias or explicit hate. Undetected hate hiding deep in our brains is still hate, just like a little cancer is still cancer. You don't want even a smidgen inside you. Thankfully, researchers are coming up with more and more evidence that interventions work, and so we arrive at the next part of the formula for countering hate, what I'll call connection thinking, the conscious effort to neutralize the stereotypes embedded in our amygdala. Researchers generally call this debiasing, and they're getting promising results. Consider this study. New York University psychologist Daniel Yudkin and Jay Van Bevel had subjects play a game online with other people. In certain cases, the subjects saw one of the other players, actually a member of the research team, steal another player's money. The subjects were then given a choice to punish the thief by taking some or taking all of the thief's money and ejecting that player from the game. What the researchers manipulated was the identity of the thief. Sometimes the subject believed the thief was a fan of the same football team as the subject. But sometimes the thief was a fan of the rival team. Or sometimes the subject and thief were from the same country, sometimes not. Perhaps not surprisingly, given what we've already learned, Yudkin and Van Bevel found that people punished members of outgroups more harshly and went easy on in-group members, whichever way the groupings had been defined. But even more interesting and encouraging was that when the researchers asked subjects to reflect before making their punishment decisions, their biases basically went away. They handed out equal punishments to everyone, whether they were in their in-group or their out-group. In another experiment, Princeton University psychologist Susan Fiske used a simple strategy to erase people's bias. When Fiske showed pictures of unknown black faces to white participants, their amygdala activity predictably spiked. But when Fiske instructed the research subjects to guess the favorite vegetable of the people in the pictures, their amygdala activation remained the same, whether they were shown pictures of white people or black people. Just thinking about what vegetable these unknown folks might enjoy, having to engage in the process of trying to take the perspective of the other, was enough to break down bias. And remember the study in which Elizabeth Phelps and her team showed people random yearbook photos of black and white people with neutral facial expressions? After observing that most of the white subjects' amygdala lit up more when shown pictures of black faces, Phelps and her team tried a different experiment. They showed the white subjects the faces of well-liked famous people, both white and black. And this time, their amygdala activation was significantly lower. So in other words, just knowing people, just having more real-life exposure to others, changes the way our brains activate in response. That's more great support for the importance of creating more connection spaces that then help foster connection thinking. These are all studies conducted in labs, of course, and life is not a controlled experiment. But one more study I'll cite shows promising signs that if we will acknowledge that we have implicit bias, we can consciously train our minds to disregard it. Talma Hendler and other neuroscientists at Tel Aviv University hooked subjects up to a fancy computer that allowed them to monitor their fMRI results themselves, watching in real time as their amygdala activation rates were being tested. With a little bit of coaching and a lot of encouragement, when they were shown stimuli that were meant to trigger their fear mechanisms and at the same time were shown a screen where their amygdala were lighting up, people could deliberately lower their amygdala stimulation. Just getting that feedback helped people regulate their own unconscious mental processes. What that study indicates, and what neuroscientists have been learning through a massive volume of research in the last few decades, is that like a computer, our brains are made up of hardware and software. The amygdala is part of our hardware and performs the same basic functions in all of us, like a processor or a memory card in a computer we all buy from the same store. But what each of our particular amygdala learns to fear or even hate, that's what therapist Athena Stayek calls soft-wired information. specific coding written by our lives and the society around us, which means it can be reprogrammed. Doing so starts with awareness. According to Yudkin and Van Bevel, acknowledging the truth about ourselves, that we see and think about the world through the lens of group affiliations, is the first step to making things better. So the answer isn't to ignore biases, as with arguments about colorblindness or attacks on identity politics, but rather to acknowledge them and keep working at consciously countering them. We're not going to change our stereotyped thinking overnight, and we certainly won't change it long-term simply because we imagine someone's favorite vegetable. But with concerted effort over time, we can make great headway. When I was a baby activist in the late 1990s working in the LGBT rights movement while finishing up college, a group of scientists was trying to prove the existence of a gay gene. These scientists themselves were gay and believed that objections to equal rights laws could be overcome by proving gayness to be immutable. There was a problem, though. The idea that no one would choose to be gay was implicitly rooted not in equality, but in inferiority. And the inference was that rights should be extended out of pity, not principle. That's not justice. For example, religion is definitely not genetic, and it's usually consciously chosen, but no one ever argues that we shouldn't protect religious freedom. In the end, gay gene research fanned pre-existing debates about the biological worth of gay people in particular, and it fed into what were then scientifically popular notions that our character as human beings could be boiled down not only to biology, but to fixed and unyielding biology. A society that had for centuries built itself around subjective hate was increasingly trying to objectively rationalize that hate with junk science, arguing that certain communities were biologically prone to criminality and promiscuity and poverty, and then arguing that hate itself wasn't subjective and immoral, but rather also biologically predetermined, a hardwired reaction to the world. Thus, at every turn in the gaping injustice and inequality in U.S. society, someone or another has tried to prove that such injustice and inequality has natural roots, to absolve the rest of us from our role in perpetuating and prospering under the imbalanced status quo. Sure, to some extent, our minds have the raw capacity to hate, but who we hate and how we hate is softwired into our systems by society. And in the middle of that, we get to choose what we do. Just like my being gay isn't solely the interplay between some unknown biological predilection and society's social pressures and counter-dynamics, I get to choose how and to what extent every day I'm going to be and act super-duper gay. You also get to choose whether to hate me. That's your call. You don't get to blame neurobiology or society. As it happens, near the end of my dinner with Scotty Nell, she and I get into a heated debate about nature versus nurture, how much inequality is just baked into humanity as opposed to how much is softwired by society and our biases. You have to at least acknowledge that we have a problem with racism in this country, and we continue to systematically treat black people as less than, I say to Scotty Nell. If you don't acknowledge that, then you're never going to solve it. We're not in the 1950s, Scotty now replies. We're not in the 1960s. We're not even the 70s or 80s. This is now. Why do you think black people have less wealth and lower graduation rates? I ask. Scotty Nell's reply is decisive. I think that's something they need to address within their own community. I point out that statistically, white high school dropouts have on average a higher net worth than black college graduates, which has only two possible explanations. It's either that we have a longer, bigger problem of some kind of hidden, unconscious racism as a society that we're not addressing, I say. Or these lazy black folks just haven't tried hard enough, and that's why they're poor. I don't agree with that, Scotty Nell replies. Which part? Either, she says. So what then? I press. I think you have to look at the environments and what's been the focus of those environments, Scotty Nell replies. You're saying it's their fault? I say. No, Scotty Nell says. I'm saying you look at the culture of hip-hop music, and I have hip-hop music. I love hip-hop. I love urban music. But the culture that exists in their pop music of degrading women, encouraging violence against police, encouraging violence against each other, versus a country music song. There's no misogyny in country music songs, I ask her. Name one, she says. I don't know. I can't, I confess. I don't know country music songs. You can't, she triumphs. Mind you, I can't name a hip-hop song either, I add. Okay, well, there's a big difference, Scotty now continues. The hate that is in that pop culture, that environment, is a reflection sometimes of what's going on, or else it wouldn't be popular. You would not have certain songs. Her voice trails off, and then she adds, this has been going on since the 1980s. Well, something's been going on, but maybe not what Scotty Nell thinks. In 1999, social psychologist Carrie Freed published an innovative study on this very question. She took lyrics from an obscure folk song by the Kingston Trio, a song called Bad Man's Blunder, which told the tale of a young man who intentionally shoots and kills a police officer. Freed printed out a section of the song's lyrics on paper and gave them to research subjects, most of whom were white. Half the subjects were told the lyrics were from a country song. Half the subjects were told the lyrics were from a rap song. And that made all the difference. Subjects who thought they'd read rap lyrics rated the song as significantly more offensive and dangerous than subjects did when they thought they were country lyrics. In other words, perceptions about the music and overall culture weren't governed by objective reality, but by unconscious bias. Race is an idea, not a fact, explains historian Nell Irvin Painter. Yet what is a fact is that our history and our minds, past and present, are irrevocably shaped by our country's unique idea and expression of race. Implicit bias is also a fact. We can see it in our brains and in our reflexes, in our assumptions and our institutions. And if we don't see our biases, all of our biases, and do something about them, we're at risk of those biases being manipulated, twisted, and turned toward even darker ends. In fact, while it may be hard to think about and grasp our unconscious biases, the consequences of those biases being exacerbated and exploited on a systemic level can be truly horrific. Chapter 5. When Hate Becomes Pandemic, The Genocide. Forgiveness is not forgetting. Forgiveness is freedom from hate. Valerie Carr. When I step out of the airport in Kigali, Rwanda, in November 2016, the air smells like burning trash. I'm told that if I'd been there 22 years ago, it would have smelled like rotting flesh. Of course, as an American, I wouldn't have been there then. Every embassy worker from the U.S. and every other country's diplomats and most of the rest of foreigners in the country fled. During a period of 100 days in 1994, Rwanda's Hutu majority killed approximately 800,000 of the nation's Tutsi minority. The Rwandan genocide is, in fact, often described as the fastest genocide in world history. A breathtaking average of 8,000 people were murdered every day, many by their own friends and neighbors. Thousands and thousands of ordinary people. It is estimated that at least 200,000 Hutus participated in the genocide, became, in the words of genocide scholar Daniel Goldhagen, willing executioners. This is what happens when hate, like wildfire, is deliberately spread nationwide. When evil reaches a massive pandemic scale, most of those who are not the direct victims just look the other way. It's as though if genocide isn't happening to us personally, we feel bad. But we don't feel connected, like it has nothing to do with us, our history, our hate. Too often, especially those of us in the West, think genocide is some unusual thing that only happens to unusual people in unusual places. We think it can never happen to us, or because of us. How wrong we are. When the Rwandan genocide began, John Gureneza, a Tutsi, was 20 years old. John grew up in the Bugesera district in eastern Rwanda, in a village about an hour's drive from Kigali, the country's capital. The area around his village is called the Ruwuru sector, which is a lush valley named for Lake Ruwuru, which straddles the border with Burundi. Rural Rwanda is a study in stark contrasts. Lush green avocado, mango, and citrus trees sprout in clusters like mirages out of an otherwise relentless topography of dirt and dust. I drive to John's village with my guide, Solange Uwera, a young Rwandan woman with a heap of braids worn sometimes on top of her head, sometimes cascading down her back. When we pass the villages on the way to Bugesera, groups of tiny children are running around in the fields and through the streets. I notice that all the boys and girls have their heads shaved. It's expensive to care for hair in Rwanda. Solange's braids are a luxury. Eventually, our driver turns off the main road, and we bump along a dirt one for several miles, passing lines of women in colorful kente fabric wrap skirts and t-shirts, large nylon sacks balanced on their heads. They are probably carrying beans or rice, Solange tells me. One of the women has an extra cloth tied around her waist, and I can see the head of a baby just peeking out the back and gently bumping up and down as she walks. Then we pass a camel, and like a kid on a safari, I point excitedly and whip out my phone to take a picture. But so do Solange and the driver. Laughing, they tell me they've never seen a camel in Rwanda, or anywhere in sub-Saharan Africa for that matter. They have no idea what the hell it's doing there. In the spirit of the apparent absurdity, I decide to tell that joke that the one sloth tells the other sloth in the movie Zootopia. What do you call a three-humped camel? Pregnant. Solange doesn't laugh, and when she translates it to our driver, he doesn't laugh either. Apparently, a camel is funny in Rwanda, but I'm not. While camels are an anomaly in rural Rwanda, cows are everywhere, including on everyone's mind. Coming from the United States, where we can buy mass-produced, albeit chemically loaded beef for $1.99 a pound, it's hard for me at first to grasp the important role of cattle in Rwanda. The country is historically and epically cow-centric. Rwandan obsession to cattle dates back to history when a man's wealth and manhood were considered by the number of long-horned cattle he possessed, reads an article in the New Times, Rwanda's English Language Daily. Cows were the only acceptable form of dowry and are still the best present to give a friend. Not only do Rwandans name their cows, but some even name their children after cow-like attributes. There are kids with names like Munganyinka, she is as valuable as a cow, Zaninka, bring a cow, and my favorite, Nizamokosha, I will exchange her for a cow. All these names are meant to show the great significance of cattle in the Rwandan culture, I learned from the article in the New Times. During my interviews, in every rural village I visited, everyone talked about cows in the context of the genocide, how so-and-so Tutsi had so many cows that others were jealous, or how a Tutsi gave a cow to his Hutu neighbors to try to prevent the Hutu from killing him. In Rwanda, cows are both powerful symbols and hard currency. John Garaneza is from a Tutsi family that had cows. A lot of cows. More than 200. His father was very wealthy by village standards. John's father also had a lot of wives, 10 to be exact, each with her own home. The homes weren't fancy by Western standards, but they were as nice or nicer than those of most Hutu families, who only had one. John's father didn't have as many children as he had cows, but he had a lot of children, too. John had 36 brothers and sisters spread among the 10 wives and some other women. John's own mother was not one of his father's wives, and after John was born, she left. John's father kept him, and he was raised by the 10 mothers. At mealtime, he and a gaggle of his siblings would start out eating at one mother's house and then go to another and then another until they were full. At night, he could sleep in whichever house he wanted. It sounds like a pretty fun childhood, actually. Or a reality TV show. Incidentally, because I'm sure you're wondering, too, John's father would spend 2 nights in each wife's house in a scheduled rotation. Life was good for John, until suddenly it was not. John's father was killed in the lead-up to the genocide, and on the second day of the genocide, the rest of his family was slaughtered. The killing was done with intimate sloppiness. I'd heard that the Rwandan genocide wasn't committed solely by the Hutu-run military, or even the Interahamwe, trained armed militias of civilian Hutu extremists, but also by Hutu civilians, who picked up the machetes in their backyards and hacked their neighbors to death at close range. Close enough for slayer and victim to look into each other's eyes. Before I went to Rwanda, I figured it must not really be true that Hutus killed their actual friends. I imagine what the historians meant was the equivalent of my suddenly attacking that guy who lives up the street, someone I say hi to regularly when I walk by, but whose name I don't know, or anything else about him, so we aren't technically friends. Which would, of course, be plenty horrible by itself. But I soon learned that in many cases, the Hutus and the Tutsis they killed really were friends, close friends. I met several Hutu perpetrators who were the godparents of their Tutsi friends' kids and had family dinners together every weekend. In fact, in some mixed Hutu-Tutsi families, people were killed by their own husbands or wives. Whenever I bring up the Rwandan genocide in conversation, I promise I really am fun at parties, No one thinks they could ever slaughter their neighbors, let alone family members. Lots of people I talk with are against trolling and bullying and political incivility, but can at least recognize the germs of that same hatred inside themselves. With enough pondering, they can imagine extreme life circumstances that could have turned them into a racist like Arno or a terrorist like Bassam. But slaughter their neighbors? People who do that must be monsters, right? In truth, what makes mass atrocities like the Rwandan genocide so hard to fathom is that so many perfectly normal people not only look the other way at the horror, but often actively, even enthusiastically, participate. In Rwanda, hundreds of thousands of people were massacred, hundreds of thousands more were raped and maimed, and millions of lives were destroyed and displaced, not because a few evil monsters did unspeakably evil things, but because by and large, good, even loving people did unspeakably evil things. I met many of them, and they were not monsters. Equally disconcerting is that the killing can't be attributed to the Hutus losing their minds in a mass spasm of uncontrollable rage. As fast as it was, the slaughter continued for 100 days. The Hutu perpetrators I met told me they had not lost either their consciousness or their conscience during the horrors they were committing. They knew in the moment, what they were doing was wrong. Some of the perpetrators even helped rescue and hide Tutsi children or friends while simultaneously killing other Tutsis. A Hutu gang member recounted to a journalist, "If by misfortune I caught sight of an acquaintance, like a soccer comrade, for example, a pang pinched my heart, and I left him to a nearby colleague. But I had to do this quietly. I could not reveal my good heart." His good heart could call out to him. And yet, he could also keep right on killing. Former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, titled her book about genocide, A Problem from Hell. But while the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre wrote, "Hell is other people," the American playwright Tennessee Williams argued, "Hell is yourself." American ethicist Nell Noddings warns, "Evil does not have a stomach-turning stench, nor does it signal its presence with palpable cold and darkness. We do not fall haplessly, nor does it entrap, possess us. Rather, we often act willfully in complicity with it." Such mass atrocities can happen only because many fundamentally decent human beings participate, and many other decent people fail to intervene. When we take that in, we realize that genocide is terrifying not only because it happened to them, but because it could also happen to us, and that we could just as easily be the victims or the perpetrators. In every genocide, some people do resist. Many know of Paul Rusesabagina, a Hutu who, as concierge of the fancy Hotel des Mille Collines in Kigali, helped to hide and protect over 1,200 Tutsis and Hutus. His story was the basis for the movie Hotel Rwanda. There are other rescuers, but the exact number isn't known. An estimated 25,000 to 45,000 Hutus were killed in the genocide. But many of them were killed simply for being moderates who didn't support the extremist government, not because they intervened to save Tutsis. Others were killed because they looked Tutsi. As of 2016, there were less than 50 confirmed examples of rescuers during the genocide. As heartening and instructive as it is to know that these brave souls existed, they constituted a tiny fraction of Rwanda's overall population of 5.95 million Hutus in 1994. Similarly, during the Holocaust, active resistors of Nazi atrocities against Jews are estimated to have made up just 0.5% of the entire civilian population. We might all like to believe, as Scottie Nell Hughes did in my conversation with her at the Moton Museum, that had we been the ones faced with that moment in history, we would have done the right thing. But the problem is, as the numbers starkly show again and again, most people don't. The question about Rwanda is, what lessons does the genocide hold for those of us who want to stop the spread of hate in our culture? How can good people be so willingly recruited to serve the interests of hate, even when the consequences are so extreme? I wanted to understand what genocide can tell us about how such intense hate systemically engulfs a whole society and how its spread can be systemically prevented. What I learned is that a combination of long stewing resentments, explicit dehumanizing propaganda, and official sanctioning of violence fuel explosive hate. A genocide doesn't just spontaneously erupt. Even one as ferociously fast-burning as the Rwandan genocide was. The flames are strategically, societally fanned. And what I find deeply troubling about the lessons of Rwanda for the United States and the rest of the world is that the embers of hatred are being stoked in so many places today, in so many similar ways. During the 2016 presidential election in the U.S., I met Yannick Tona, a young Tutsi who survived the Rwandan genocide and was attending Texas Christian University on a scholarship. Yannick immediately starts our conversation on a foreboding note. Oh my God, you guys are doing what we were doing 25 years before the genocide in my country, or 10 years before the genocide, Yannick says, almost jumping out of the couch he's sitting on in the school bookstore lounge. Maybe not on the same level or as extremist as in my country at that time, but it's just all these elements, and I'm like, what's going on in this country? The more I live here, the more I get depressed about it. Like, oh my God, this is worse than I thought. Yannick, three-fourths of whose extended family was slaughtered in the Rwandan genocide, is now warning us that the same thing can happen here. Maybe Rwanda and Nazi Germany and Cambodia and the former Yugoslavia weren't bizarre aberrations, but merely examples of how any culture in any country might turn monstrous. I'm not suggesting that I think the United States is at risk of genocide anytime soon. At the very least, though, Americans should be terrified that a survivor of the Rwandan genocide hears the same type of hatred that lit his own country on fire being spewed here. As should Europeans about the mounting hatred being voiced there. After all, history's worst genocide didn't happen in Africa or the Middle East, but in Germany. The Rwandan genocide speaks volumes about the dangers of manipulatively pitting social groups against one another, as thought leaders in spreading hate are so avidly doing in the U.S. and around the globe, which can have truly disastrous consequences. It's also a lesson about how our own forms of hate, which we might think of as trivial, can become deadly. The resentments between Hutus and Tutsis resulted largely from colonial meddling. While Hutus and Tutsis had long been distinct identity groups, and Hutus tended to be farmers while Tutsis herded cattle, and thus did enjoy a higher status, the groups were not in heated conflict until the late 1800s, when German and then Belgian colonial powers seized control of the region. In fact, Philip Gourevitch, the author of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, about the Rwandan genocide, explains that prior to the colonial conquest, Hutus and Tutsis intermarried to such an extent that ethnographers and historians agree that Hutus and Tutsis cannot properly be called distinct ethnic groups. As a UN report on the genocide describes it, prior to the colonial era, Tutsis generally occupied the higher strata in the social system and the Hutus the lower. However, social mobility was possible. A Hutu who acquired a large number of cattle or other wealth could be assimilated into the Tutsi group. An impoverished Tutsi would be regarded as Hutu. During the so-called scramble for Africa, the nations of Europe saw fit to divide the continent among themselves, and eventually the region that included the Kingdom of Rwanda was given to Germany. Through a twisted history of deeply condescending and fundamentally racist otherizing, the Germans officially designated Tutsis as superior to Hutus, and they awarded more local ruling power and economic privilege to Tutsis. After World War I, the League of Nations gave Rwanda to Belgium, and the Belgians not only maintained the ethnic divisions of power established by the Germans, but took them a sinister step further, issuing identity cards that labeled Rwandans as either Hutu, Tutsi, or Twa, a minority pygmy tribe that makes up less than 1% of the country. The Germans and Belgians turned ethnic distinctions into major economic and political divisions. The history of identity politics in Rwanda echoes the history of how social group identities have been invented and employed elsewhere in the world to serve the interests of the powerful. For instance, much of the Zionist justification for dominating the totality of the land of Israel centers on a specious claim that there was no historic Palestinian identity before the State of Israel was formed. The implication is that a people who don't categorize themselves as people don't deserve their own political sovereignty. Similarly, the cultural identity of the people of East Timor was partly crystallized as a reaction against Portuguese colonization and then occupation by Indonesia. The emerging independent identity that was defined in reaction to such oppression increased simultaneously with the desire for political independence. Remember that while tribalism may be inherent in human beings, the way those tribes are shaped and how they are set against other groups often stems from the purposeful political manipulation of tribalism. The handiwork of the colonial powers in Rwanda led to lasting social unrest. Hutus in Rwanda had been massacring Tutsis on and off since the waning days of Belgian colonial rule in the late 50s, writes Gourevitch. During Rwanda's struggle for independence in the 1960s, tens of thousands of Tutsis were killed, and an estimated 40 to 70% of the remaining Tutsi population fled the country, many across the border into Uganda. In 1959, the Hutu-led independence movement took charge of the newly independent Rwanda. Over the years, the Tutsi exiles kept trying to invade and overthrow the Hutu government. One incarnation of that effort was the Rwandan Patriotic Front, RPF, which in 1990 invaded Rwanda and took control of some territory in the country's northeast. To those watching ignorantly from the outside, the Hutu genocide against the Tutsis came across as a spontaneous outbreak of pure insanity. Indeed, that's how the extremist Hutu government that directed the killing later tried to portray it. But Rwanda's Hutu president, Juvenal Habyarimana, and his wife, Agatha, had been plotting annihilation of the Tutsis since Habyarimana seized power in a coup in 1973. Agatha Habyarimana coordinated the group of Hutu extremists who meticulously planned the genocide, including recruiting and training the Interahamwe militias. In 1992, the Hutu extremists conducted a dry run of their genocidal plans. They killed several hundred Tutsis around the country. John Gueraneza's father was one of them. John was 18 years old at the time. "I was coming home from school when I met a group of attackers on the road," John recalls. "They said to me, 'We will attack your home and kill you.' That night the group came to John's house and slaughtered his father with a machete, but they harmed no other family members. John's father died the following morning as the next phase of full-blown genocide was being birthed." State-sponsored propaganda increasingly targeted Tutsis. One popular radio station mixed popular music with hours and hours of venomous lies about the RPF and, by association, labeled all Tutsis Inyenzi, cockroaches. In an extremist newspaper, Hutu activists printed a list of the Hutu Ten Commandments, which included statements like, "Every Hutu should know that every Tutsi is dishonest in business. His only aim is the supremacy of his ethnic group." While the Hutu extremists were winding up the machinery for genocide, they were also fomenting a murderous mindset. On August 6, 1994, President Habyarimana's plane was shot down, and Habyarimana died. Propaganda radio broadcasts instantly pinned the blame on Tutsis. Who shot the plane down is actually still in dispute, but the claim that Tutsis had done it was the spark that started the fire. Within hours, Agatha Habyarimana's posse gave the order to the Hutsi extremist-controlled military and the Interahamwe to begin mass killings. Propaganda radio issued explicit commands for Hutus to find Tutsis and stand near this place and encircle them and kill them because they are there. It was just one day later, on April 7th, that John Gueraneza returned from tending cattle to find the rest of his family being massacred. A combination of the government military, the Interahamwe, and other Hutus from his village had launched the attack. As John hid in the hills, he saw attackers repeatedly rape two of his sisters. Afterward, their attackers shoved wooden posts through each girl's vagina until they pierced their skulls. Another group of attackers buried one of John's younger brothers alive in the ground, and then stood watch over the mound of dirt to make sure the child didn't escape death. "Our houses had been set on fire," John recalls slowly between deep breaths. "Grenades were exploding, and cows were screaming." When it was over, all 10 mothers and 27 of John's brothers and sisters were murdered. There was nothing John could have done to stop the slaughter. The gang of killers was large, well-armed, and well-trained. John could only keep himself hidden and watch in agony. Then he fled farther up into the hills to search for other Tutsis. He wanted to form a group of Tutsis to fight back. Many Hutus and Tutsis rightfully blame the propaganda for whipping up the genocide. But why was it so effective? While clearly inter-ethnic animosity had plagued the country for decades, the fact is that most Hutus didn't start out as enthusiastic executioners. I met many Hutus who had participated in the killing who told me they had not hated those they murdered. One of those was Leonard Rukogoza. I was introduced to him in the living room of Marie Izagariza, a Tutsi who lives in the same village as John Gurineza. She lost her husband and 5 of her 8 children in the genocide. It was Leonard who slaughtered Marie's husband and then pushed 2 of her children, who were 6 and 9 years old, down a well, then stood guard, making sure they didn't escape, as they slowly starved to death. Up until that moment, their families had been friendly, including enjoying holidays and celebratory meals together. Like John Garanez's father, Marie's husband was wealthy. He owned many cows, so many, in fact, that he had given cows to some of his neighbors, including Leonard. As we sit together in Marie's home, Marie tells me, "I never felt hate between Hutus and Tutsis before." Leonard is one of those who blames the radio propaganda, saying that it taught us that Tutsis should be killed. He insists, "I didn't feel hate against Tutsis during the entire period." I gasp. "Really?" I say, trying to hide my cynicism. "Really," Leonard says. Then he raises another motivation that fueled the killing. "I felt, you know, I should kill them. We were taught if you kill Tutsis, you can take their property. You should kill him so you can freely take his belongings." After Leonard killed Marie's husband, he took the family's cows. Many Hutu perpetrators and other Hutus I spoke with also try to tell me the killing was motivated more by greed than hate. Marie-Jean Uemana is among them. Marie-Jean was 10 years old when the genocide started. She lived with her father and mother and sister a mile or so from John Garaneza's family, not in the same village, but close enough that she knew of John's family and he knew of hers. Eventually, John and Marie-Jean would become even closer, but only after the genocide tore apart both their lives. Marie-Jean's father was a farmer, and she has fond memories of her childhood of helping him sell his avocados. Marie-Jean remembers her father coming home at night with new things for her and her sister, things he had stolen from the Tutsi families he'd helped slaughter. One Tutsi her father killed was a family friend who used to give Marie-Jean's family land for farming. I ask Marie-Jean why she thinks her father participated in the killing. "Imagine killing someone who used to give you a living," she tells me. She concedes that it is true that they have been trained to kill, whether formally through the Interahamwe or through propaganda. "But mostly those who took part in the genocide were driven by greed," Marie-Jean says definitively. Still, I can't help wondering if that's not the explanation she gives, because it's better to be a thief than a monster. How can greed explain why Leonard killed 2 young children? Or the widespread brutality against women who controlled no property? Yannick Tona, the Tutsi student at Texas Christian University, was just 4 years old when the genocide began. He hid in his grandmother's house with his mother and 3 siblings, as well as aunts and uncles, 16 in total. Eventually, they fled the house, thinking their best bet was to hide in pairs and try to escape. Only Yannick, his mother, his sister, and his uncle survived. Yannick tells me that his grandmother stayed with his baby brother, taking cover in the backyard. But the baby cried. He was 1 year old and just making baby noises, Yannick says as we talk in the atrium of the university bookstore. The Hutu attackers heard Yannick's baby brother and found him and his grandmother. "My grandmother was raped," Yannick speaks stoically, but tears well in his wide eyes. "And my brother, they took him and beat him on the wall, beat his brains to bits, and then forced my grandma to drink the blood. Then they killed his grandmother." Yannick tells me that the attackers were neighbors who my grandmother's family had lived with for generations. At one point during my time in Rwanda, I visit a church in Ntarama, a village on the way to where both John and Marie-Jean grew up, in the Bugesera district. When the genocide started, the Tutsis from the surrounding area sought sanctuary in the church. But like other expats, the Italian Catholic priests fled the country, leaving their flock to defend themselves. Thousands of people locked themselves in the small church in Ntarama, hoping that together they could ward off the Hutu militias or that somehow God would help. It was in a small outbuilding that used to be the Sunday school, where all the babies were sheltered. Hutu militants used a grenade to blow a hole in the side of the Sunday school building and then, one by one, killed the babies by holding on to their legs and swinging their heads against a wall at the front of the room. There's still a dark patch of stained bricks on the wall. While greed certainly seems to have played a part in the genocide, and certainly economic resentment overall fueled much of the ethnic tension Hutus felt toward Tutsis, what happened in Rwanda can't be boiled down to just greed alone. The genocide was a perfect storm of outgroup otherizing, a terrifying testament to how readily intense feelings of competitive victimhood, anger, and disgust toward demonized social groups can be fermented toward extremely deadly ends. Crucial to the story is that with its propaganda and training of militias, the government established that killing Tutsis was the responsibility of Hutus. The government established a new social norm that Hutus felt duty-bound to conform with. Just like racial discrimination and violence was the norm in North America in the 1750s and 1850s and 1950s, brutality was made normative in Rwanda. And that explains why normal people, like Leonard Rukogoza, could kill people they didn't hate. Leonard, and human beings generally, have an inclination to conform to social norms, which is deeply troubling when the norms themselves are hateful. To help wrap my head around how brutality can become so normative, in fact so normal, I spoke with philosopher Elizabeth Minnick. She was a student and protege of one of history's most renowned philosophers, Hannah Arendt, who turned the world's understanding of evil upside down. Arendt was born in Germany in 1906 and escaped the Holocaust, eventually resettling in the United States. In the 1950s, she published two important works, The Origins of Totalitarianism and The Human Condition, both exploring the theme of freedom as it relates to the individual, society, and political regimes. But it was in 1961 that Hannah Arendt became a household name. That year, The New Yorker magazine sent her to Jerusalem to cover the trial of Adolf Eichmann, who had been a lieutenant under Adolf Hitler during the Holocaust. Eichmann designed and managed the logistics for deporting millions of Europe's Jews into concentration camps, where most were killed. What Arendt reported back to the United States and the world was shocking. Eichmann, she said, wasn't a monster, but a pretty average person who was mindlessly following orders. But if Eichmann wasn't a monster, how could you explain his monstrous acts? In offering an answer, Arendt coined the phrase, the banality of evil. She meant not that the evil Eichmann committed was banal, but that he was banal, an ordinary person who did extraordinarily awful things. About Eichmann's banality, Arendt wrote, it was sheer thoughtlessness, something by no means identical with stupidity, that predisposed him to become one of the greatest criminals of that period. Eichmann had a curious, quite authentic inability to think. What Arendt particularly emphasized was that Eichmann didn't seem to have questioned in the slightest the new norms of brutality being established by the Nazi Party, norms that, like the dehumanization of Tutsis in Rwanda, were carefully spread over time. Arendt argued that it's an individual's responsibility to challenge social norms and, when need be, defy them. She called such independent-mindedness thinking without a banister. But more often than not, Arendt argued, we cling to norms in the way we grip a banister on a treacherous flight of stairs. The focus of Elizabeth Minnick's work has been to try to deconstruct this banister-clinging mode of thinking. Minnick writes in her book, The Evil of Banality, since my first encounters with dramatic injustices, I have increasingly felt that understanding thinking, and so also thoughtlessness, and so also banality in its many forms, is for me the most pressing moral and political quest. Now a senior fellow at the Association of American Colleges and Universities, Minnick helped me understand what she calls extensive evil, which she differentiates from individual crimes of desperation or passion, like robbing a bank or killing a lover. Basically, there are two kinds of evil, she tells me over the phone from her home in North Carolina. One is intensive. It begins and ends pretty quickly and is surrounded by a normalcy that makes us so shocked when it's violated. Intensive crimes include random physical attacks and murders. The other type of evil, Minnick explains, is extensive. It involves mass crimes committed not by individuals or small groups of offenders, but whole communities or societies. Her point is that while intensive crime is plainly wrong and abhorrent to everyone else observing it, extensive evil is not. Extensive evil may indeed shock and horrify us from a distance, she says. But the fact is, it's normal for its time. When Minnick says